Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Meenoosh Shafiq, and I'm the director of the London School of Economics and Political Science. And we are delighted to have all of you here with us today for the launch event of LSE's Global Economic Governance Commission. The commission is intended to facilitate a global conversation informed by research and expertise about the future of global economic governance. When we began planning the commission, the goal was to rebuild the norms, policies, and institutions of global governance in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, where I think many of us thought that the world had done very well in managing this global crisis. And we were responding to comments from people like Kristalina Georgieva, who argued that we needed a new Bretton Woods moment as far back as October 2020, as well as previous calls for a need to refresh the global economic order. But now we have several new crises that have complicated our task. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has triggered an energy and food price crisis on top of the very painful Volcker-esque monetary tightening that is now underway, with the inevitable risks around capital flow reversals for many developing countries. Sanctions and the weaponization of the global financial system raises huge questions for the future of globalization and integration. And all of this is layered in a context of pre-existing crises, the climate crisis, the widening of global inequality, and the deterioration of US-China economic relations. The challenge for the reform of global economic governance will not only be in coming up with the right policies to address these and other crises. We will also need to identify and formulate the right politics. An unfortunate and underlying element of today's poly-crisis, as we're calling it, is that multilateralism and the capacity for multilateral institutions are in dire straits for both international reasons and for domestic reasons. International gridlock has paralyzed the World Trade Organization, and we've had no progress on trade liberalization in decades. Extreme domestic polarization has delayed and diluted policies such as the IMF's $650 billion SDR allocation, which is the largest amount the fund is able to do without authorization from Congress. And even when we can identify the right policies, we're undermined by the lack of the right politics. We'll need to try and find a way to ensure that proposals don't get stuck in domestic and political, international, or geopolitical mud. We'll have to find crafty and often quiet solutions to navigate the international rifts between Russia and the West, the US and China, and the global North and the global South. And those navigation skills will be critical for getting any reform and policies through what is a very divided world. We'll also have to be realistic about the problems which we can credibly solve and those for which the political conditions simply do not currently exist and cannot easily be created. And yet we all know that, as is often said, global problems require global solutions. And so unless we find ways to enable global cooperation, we will be stuck in the very divided and difficult world that is so crisis prone that we find ourselves in today. Now, as you can see from our roster of commissioners, we've had an embarrassment of riches to choose from in organizing this initial launch panel. For today's event, we're joined by three eminent LSE academics: Professor Chris Alden, who's the director of LSE Ideas and professor of international relations; Professor Lord Nick Stern, who's the IG Patel Professor of Economics and Government and Chair of the Grantham Research Institute; and Dr. K. Yu Jin, Associate Professor of Economics in our Department of Economics. So I'm going to ask each of these commissioners to spend 10 minutes raising the issues that are of concern to them. I'll ask a few questions from the chair, and then I'll open it up to a conversation more broadly with those of you in the audience. This is meant to be a public conversation, so please engage. Please enter your name, affiliation, and questions using the Q&A function. Also, feel free to vote for the questions that you'd like to see answered, and LSE Ideas and staff will assist in putting those toward the commissioners. For those of you continuing the discussion on Twitter, please make use of the hashtag hashtag LSEGEGC and hashtag global economic governance. So with that, let me start with Professor Chris Alden to launch the discussion. Chris, over to you.
Great. Thanks very much, Manoush, and thanks, colleagues, for this opportunity to unpack and launch unpack some of the ideas and launch our initiative. I'd like to begin my contribution by reflecting upon the notion of this being a Bretton Woods moment. I think that this is a powerful idea and one that periodically comes up over time. I think it behooves us, however, to look at the sort of historical parallels with other Bretton Woods moments and where they situate as compared to our own. The first, of course, of the Bretton Woods moments would be the creation of the system itself in 1944. And the second was in 1971 with the closing of the gold window. And what we are calling the third could be our own setting, the thing you described, Manoush, in detail. If we were to look at the very first of these, I think that the very first of the Bretton Woods moments, we have to recognize that was a very distinctive time. Geopolitics at its zenith. The war was still rumbling on and with the devastation to millions of lives, not just in Europe, but in Asia, across North Africa, and elsewhere. This set the conditions for a very different kind of gathering of individual state representatives than we would have had in other settings. For instance, at Bretton, when the Allies, and it was the Allies in this, met in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in July 1944, most of the world was not there. They weren't present. They were represented through different structures, institutions, but they were not present. The Axis powers weren't present. So three large economies, of course, because they were the object of the war. Germany, Japan, and Italy, but the entire colonial world was not present. They were represented through the vehicles and instruments of colonial rule and rulers. This dampened possible opposition or silenced opposition voices, though a liberal enterprise, right, animated by liberal ideas, the 44 allies coming together, sharing many similar perspectives, sets of interests and concerns, we just didn't have the kind of to and fro that you might have with a more diversified grouping. So what this meant is that some of the contradictions within the liberal international reflect that tension between the power, between power, structural power, and values, liberal values, and the aspirations of universal liberal values that constructed the post-war international system. The United Nations system at large, the trusteeship council is perhaps the best example of those contradictions between liberal values and old institutional power relationships. At the same time, this was an initiative that was and is animated by liberal values, and the promise of that was perhaps best represented by the Bretton Woods institutions. The fact that change was possible, and it was going to be come through the form of development, reconstruction in the first instance, IBRC, later World Bank, followed through an ever-changing institutional approach and deepening of the development agenda. And I think that coupled to the recognition that the failings of the Depression and which contributed to, in no small way, to World War II itself, populist movements and fascist movements, that ultimately what you ended up with was a need to have institutions that reflected not just change, but also stability, IMF, holding countries together, holding economies in place. So if that was the first set of conditions which gave us the Bretton Woods one moment. We have to recognize that our international system is much more complex and the better for it. We have a system that's aware and responsive to oppositional and even antagonistic views. Those are bought into the system. It's more representative in terms of ideas, less representative in terms of societies and systems. We should have a system we should look for in re-examining this system, one that is responsive to weaker, poorer states, where power politics is not banished in any such way, but one that has the interests and conditions that these experience, these states experience, and the development impulse which drives political leadership of the best kind in these states, incorporated into any institutional reconfiguring. But we also have to recognize the difficulties of creating and maintaining that system, the tensions that we're in. So I think that we can't exclude the majority of the world from Bretton Woods 3, if I can call that where we are now, as in the way that conveners of Bretton Woods 1 did. So perhaps this is a moment like Bretton Woods 2 of the 1970s, an effort to salvage an order that has gone out of kilter, that is seen to be stumbling, not able to handle, not fit for purpose to handle some of the challenges, the transnational global challenges that we're all aware of today. And I think that this should be seen as an opportunity, as a consequence, one where we can re-examine with all those other voices, with all those other participants, institutions which have helped us achieve some of the prosperity, the fabulous prosperity in some cases that we couldn't have thought of 70 years ago, and make sure that prosperity is spread across the system more readily, that the decision-making powers are more distributed as well, and that this should help us to redesign and redefine the nexus between the infrastructures of power and the liberal values which animate these institutions, the Bretton Woods institutions that we put into place. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Let me turn now to Nick. Nick's turn, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Manoush and Chris, for the initiative. It is absolutely timely, as I will argue, and I think we all appreciate. I'm going to come at this in terms of an immense, urgent and shared problem and how we tackle it, and then ask the question, are the institutions that we have capable of responding to that challenge? So I don't start with institutional design, I start with the problem and then go back to ask the question, could our institutions handle it? My answer to that question is those institutions could handle it, but they'll have to step up and shape up in a strong way for that to happen. So that's basically my argument. So let's start with the problem. I'm not going to set out the challenge of climate change. I'm assuming that we all understand how immense that challenge is, how big are the risks that we run, and have some idea of what we have to do. But I will focus on what we have to do to tackle that problem of climate change. And I'll see it as a problem of economic development, a problem of security, all wrapped up together. I don't want to slice this off differently from the whole development story. So what we have then is a world that has, through the Paris Agreement, COP21 2015, a shared goal of holding temperature increases to well below 2 degrees and making our best efforts to hold to 1.5, and indeed COP26 in Glasgow of last November, where the attention was quite rightly focused on holding to 1.5 degrees, with a deepening understanding of just how immense are the challenges how immense are the consequences of going beyond 1.5. 2 degrees is much worse than 1.5. 3 degrees is just hugely destructive. So there is a global goal. It was established in 2015, and also 2015 established in the summer of that year, the Sustainable Development Goals. So there is a coherent Sustainable Development Agenda, including within it, and as part of it, the challenge of climate change. And that is an advance which our institutions have managed to create with a shared understanding of what our goals are. And that is a major step forward. So how do we act on that? How do we bring about the kinds of changes that we need to make to establish this new form and very exciting form of development that's sustainable, resilient, and inclusive? The world has defined for itself through the SDGs and through the Paris Agreement that agenda. So how do we deliver on that agenda? That's our question. And are our institutions up to delivery on that agenda? So let's go to COP26 in November in Glasgow. That's the Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. What happened there? Well, it actually was something which was right up at the top end of any reasonable expectation. It had a very powerful focus on net zero. I've been to all the COPs since 2006. I'm not sure that's something to be proud of, but I have. And this one was the first one where the private sector was right out in front. So net zero, private sector, natural capital, quite rightly, moved to center stage. So too did adaptation. So it was a real step up in thinking, but it was set through the Paris Agreement of COP21 in 2015. That Paris Agreement has had a very powerful effect in setting a sense of direction. Private sector firms came to COP26 in Glasgow, 6 years after Paris, where the challenge was implementation, and they were out in front, and technologies had changed enormously in that 5 or 6 years in response to a collective sense of direction. In those 5 or 6 years, renewables around the world, round the clock renewables, including storage, in many, many countries are now cheaper than fossil fuels. That was in large measure around the impetus that Paris gave, that shared sense of direction which Paris gave, and of course, all the story building up to Paris. So there was a Paris effect, and we saw it very clearly in the Glasgow Agreement. But now we come to an appreciation of the magnitude of the challenge. To get the change that we need, to cut emissions by 40% in this coming decade, to pursue strongly towards the Sustainable Development Goals set for 2030, we're going to have to invest around the world an extra 2 or 3 percentage points of GDP. And we're going to have to invest in a different way. In some countries, it's going to be more than that. Now, looking back 15, 20 years, you know, we were investing 2 or 3 percentage points GDP higher than now. But what we see, and as Chris said, this is a Bretton Woods moment. What we see is a need to ramp up investment, to cooperate internationally on that investment, to focus on infrastructure, and to act internationally. All those four things were key features of Bretton Woods One. Now, investment, infrastructure, finance, acting internationally. Now, the world has changed, of course, a great deal. We have many more countries, a much bigger private sector, different kinds of technologies, higher living standards, higher life expectations, and so on. All those things are different, but those four commonalities around investment, infrastructure, finance, international action, they are common now as they were right after the Second World War. So we've defined the challenge. We've got the objectives. We've defined the challenge. It's about sustainable development, tackling climate. And what we have to do now is to use the institutions that we have to respond to that challenge. We cannot get the investment and the associated finance and the sharing of risk and collaboration with the private sector without much stronger action from our multilateral development banks and the IMF. I believe those institutions can handle it. The question is, will they handle it? And what are the politics of them handling it? Can we get them? We have to expand our multilateral development bank lending probably by a factor of three It's amazingly cheap to do. The wonderful John Maynard Keynes, with his notion of paid-in capital and callable capital, for a one-off 40 billion shot into those institutions, one-off, you could at least double their lending, and by increasing their risk ability, handle risk, we don't have to go into the technical details, you could raise that still further. That would give you, with the right kind of collaboration with the private sector, the right kind of taking of risk, a major contribution to the kinds of investments we need to make. So I do believe that our international institutions, given their structure, could, with the right kind of expansion, handle this. Will they? And that's the politics which Minouche rightly emphasized right at the beginning. How do we get that politics in place? I think the G20 and the G7 will be absolutely fundamental. Now, the G20 is the big majority of the world's economy. It's the big majority of the ownership of these institutions. If we can get that to work, not perfectly, you know, with Trump, the G20 didn't work very well. With Putin now and this war, there'll be problems with the next G20. But we've got to learn to get that G20 and the G7 to work in ways that won't bring you unanimity, but could give you enough dynamism to put the force behind those international institutions that we need. As we expand them, as we work forward, as they step up, we're going to have to do the reforms along the way. But my point here is that we're in an enormous hurry. You know, the infrastructure investment that will shape the world, probably the infrastructure will double in the next 15 or so years, must be a new kind of infrastructure. And that rate of investment has to step up. And it has to be now. And creating, because the infrastructure we make in the next 15 or 20 years will be shaped in the next few years. So we're in a real hurry. And the point I want to emphasize here is building institutions takes time. I think everybody in the panel has been involved in building institutions. They do matter. They are center stage. But they do take time. So we're going to have to act and reform at the same time. Any idea that action waits for reform is deeply pessimistic and destructive. Let me leave it there.
Okay. Thank you so much, Nick. KU, over to you.
Thank you, Manoush. And hello to my dear colleagues from Beijing. So part of the new Bretton Woods new order, new world order, stems from the fact that there are new important players in the scene. Collectively, developing countries, of course, are accounting for a greater and greater share of the global output. And of course, one of the major players, China, has risen to the fore. And there are opportunities as well as challenges on how to engage with China to achieve some of the global governance and coordination that we have just talked about. China's economy and the weight in the world is evident. It now represents 18% of world GDP. It has contributed to a third of global growth in the last decade. It's of course the largest trading partner to many countries, the center of supply chain, and of course it has ambitions to be even more integrated in the global trading system as it upgrades its manufacturing into smart manufacturing and leverage its technological advancement to create new areas of cooperation. And of course, it has great ambitions to further enhance its financial integration, where it has been largely succeeded in terms of trade with other countries. It's still lacking in financial integration, but we know that there is ambition with the Belt Road Initiative. There is an unprecedented opening up of the financial sector, expansion of its equity markets and bond markets, and to have more foreign participation, Western financial institutions playing a bigger role in China, and of course the power and the internationalization of its currency, the RMB. So I think in the process, in the transition of a US-led post-war Bretton Woods order, giving way to a new kind of global order, of course, with all the challenges that we have mentioned. The fact that there are more than one dominant economic powers, and you know, with the onset of the pandemic, it's likely that China will in terms of economic size, be even larger than the US economy in a decade or even less, we need to think about how these global powers, very different, will interact, collaborate, and coordinate. And that will be a defining feature of the new order, the interaction between these two major players. Because in the future, we'll have to imagine two major economies, two major central banks, two completely different financial systems, substantial spillovers from both economies, not timed, not necessarily timed or coordinated, which will need to collaborate in order to save the world from financial crises, of which we're sure to have more as the pandemic continues, how to anchor the international monetary and financial system. And so there seems to be no other alternative but to work together, because we have seen in history that domestic problems, which have translated into international protectionism, was one of the key factors that made the Great Depression even greater and even more severe. And of course, today, our new challenges in issues such as climate change, global pandemics, and transnational issues, really of the transnational sort of AI displacing jobs, mounting debt in developing countries, potentially developing countries never reaching middle income status because of technological developments, a number of increasing trade tensions will merit a collaboration. So here I want to summarize, in my view, four challenges I see for global governance from an economic perspective, a macroeconomic perspective, and especially in relation to US-China dynamics. The first is deteriorating relations between US-China, the two economic superpowers. It started out as being manifested by trade, but we know that it's not about trade. It's about China's development model, China's aspirations, and Chinese technology or technological competition in particular. What is comforting to see in the last few years is that trade wars did very little of what it was intended to accomplish. The trade deficit in the US did not shrink, nor this trade surplus of China. Instead, it grew. FDI, foreign direct investment, reached an all-time high in China, which took over the US amount in 2020. Bond and equity flows into China rose in China, it rose over this period. And so we can see, and then China is still very much part of the global supply chain, not without its challenges because of the zero COVID policies and geopolitical tensions, but still, nevertheless, China's priority is still to engage with the world, globalization and economic nationalism at the same time, which in its eyes is not necessarily conflicting in the sense that, and here we come to the topic of technology is a very good example of how China views this kind of ongoing tension. Now, of course, a lot of the tension lies in this technological competition. Chinese companies, which used to rely a lot on the critical imports of critical components from the U.S. companies, there is very little confidence that that can continue. As we've seen, even with the new administration, Biden administration, more and more Chinese companies are added to the entity list, which cuts them off from critical imports of technology from the U.S. And as such, that has stoked an unprecedented techno-nationalism in China. And I would actually argue also in the US because of the rising threat of China. And this reminds us of the Japan-US technological competition in the 70s and 80s, where the US was losing out in terms of semiconductor advancement to Japan. And quickly that led to a series of policies, innovation policies that put the US on a higher technological path going forward. But China's view of continued globalization, but at the same time, developing capacity to domestically produce, innovate, procure domestic high component leading edge technologies is a reflection of China's attitude, which is to continue opening up in many, many areas, but to potentially separate some of the intractable problems such as technology from the other set of issues. And so we're seeing, if not the extreme version of decoupling in technology, very much two parallel systems advancing in the future. And that's a likely outcome. The second challenge is international monetary stability and financial stability. And here I want to mention the increasing burden of the US. Historically, we have seen this kind of transition from one financial anchor handing over to another financial anchor, one major currency giving way to another major currency in the past, in particular from Great Britain to the US. Note that the handover was not very smooth. Great Britain was had a declining share of global GDP and was increasingly unable to meet the requirements of being a financial anchor in the world trading, world financial system. But the US was neither ready to take over that responsibility. So we actually had a decade or two of two currencies being major international reserve currencies, and also which led to a system of instability and a series of financial crises and banking crises, et cetera, during the gold standard. And we are approaching the same kind of situation, an analogous situation today, because as we know, the US as a share of global GDP is declining. So, and its fiscal debt, fiscal burdens, debt and demographics, et cetera, put strains on the US's ability to be the lender, liquidity provider, and the provider of safe assets to a growing economy in which emerging markets demand ever more and more of these safe assets and liquidity. So there is, you know, an analogous challenge of the Triffin dilemma in modern times, slightly altered, but something definitely need to be considered. And then, of course, there's the political leverage of the dollar. Now, we've seen that it's, you know, incredibly powerful to some degree during the recent Ukraine-Russian crisis with the sanctions and with the freezing of the of assets, etc. But there has also been consistent opposition or challenge of the dollar's way of politicizing many of these issues. And so and this is not complaint just coming from emerging markets, but also from European countries as well, where many of these banks were heavily penalized by you know, a series of violation of American sanctions. And so that increasing burden of the US, but even more importantly, the kind of trade-off between domestic priorities and international impact is a very important one to consider. And this is beyond just financial and trade matters. But what we've seen with the US is, you know, US Fed policy has huge substantive spillovers onto the rest of the world, especially to developing countries, leading to booms and busts that are unwarranted for the domestic economies in other parts of the world. But very rarely US Fed policy is designed around what its global implications are. And sometimes these international spillovers and domestic priorities come into conflict with one another. And this is something that, you know, we're gonna have to think about how to address with new players like China, with coordination, as I mentioned, two central banks with very different views of the world and different political systems in the background. How to balance that challenge is incredibly important and challenging. And the third challenge I see is this gaping hole left of developing countries. We mentioned that a little bit, but this is in terms of, you know, a wide range of issues. First of all, they are accounting for a greater share of world output and economic activities, but their voice is not as proportionally represented in international systems and international institutions or organizations. For instance, in the wake of the financial crisis, we've seen the US providing emergency liquidity to a few of its friends and mostly advanced economies, arranging swap lines with around six countries. Now, developing countries were left in the open with insufficient amount of financial support and liquidity provision from certainly from the international organizations. And here, China, partly altruistically, but partly out of self-interest, provided some substantial amount of liquidity to these emerging markets, often bearing more risk and risk ahead of the IMF in a number of countries. And since then, it has arranged 40 swap lines with 40 countries or so to provide emergency tap into the RMB funding in times of need. And then, of course, when it comes to the trading system, we've all mentioned that we all acknowledge that there are significant problems with the WTO, one of which is that it's actually perceived to be highly unfair, both from developing countries and advanced economies alike. Advanced economies often complain about the lax IP enforcement in developing countries, and developing countries argue that many of the rules are designed to be more advantageously suited for advanced economies than for themselves, such as asking them to erect lower barriers in industries in which they have a comparative advantage, such as agriculture and textiles, etc. So we talked about infrastructure. We talked about infrastructure building, and we talked about renewables. China has been has contributed to a significant amount of renewable investment over the years, and continued to and put that as a priority. So I find it extremely important to engage with a global economy such as China, with the financial power, with the expertise in infrastructure, with the intent to devote to climate change, to devote to international collaborations on, you know, financial issues, but anti-terrorism, how to deal with tax havens, but also a range of issues such as regulations in the digital economy, digital spheres. All of this is very much part of China's willingness, intention in the global system. Now, of course, I forgot to mention that one of the big problems of the WTO system is this new player, China, that has posed a challenge because it's a developing country in terms of certain measures, but in other wide measure of areas, it is no longer a developing country, but still very much hold on to developing country rules, and that has to change. But it is very it is more likely that these dialogues, that China's position can be more in line with international rules and regulations when there is dialogue and engaging with China. So I would say that how we can manage that kind of challenge is very important. So lastly, let me just conclude by saying that for all these problems, there might not be any immediate solutions, but there have to be some thoughts about how to continue with, especially with the U.S.-China dynamics. And one is, can we separate the differences, right? The differences in politics from the competition, which could be healthy, and the collaboration. Can we separate these spheres? So competition in economics, but primarily in technology, but there could be lots of collaboration in the things that we have mentioned. And even if government may not see eye to eye, most of the collaboration is on the private front. Most of the AI research is done by a handful of countries in the world that are Chinese or American. I cannot see that we can find advances in cures to cancer and advances in science and technology and medicine without the collaboration of these two major economies with great researchers and financing and data. So both of them will want to have a stable order in order to keep their real wages growing and to foster a better future for their children. So that should be the joint objective. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Katie. Let me start with a question around the approach we need to take to thinking about global governance reform. Bretton Woods was a time when institutions were created from scratch. We're now in a world in which there are many, many institutions. In fact, arguably too many institutions when you look at the plethora of international organizations out there. One of the approaches I think of the Commission is to focus less on the institutions and more on the issues. And to say, let's think about the issues that we need to solve in the world, and then we'll figure out which institutions can, can deliver on those. And certainly my experience, like sitting in lots of G7 and G20 meetings, that's kind of how it works. You're tackling some issue and then you think, well, should we give this to the OECD or should we ask the World Bank to do this? And you sort of come to the institutional question later. And so I wanted to ask the panel, do you think that's right, that approach, issues versus institutions? And if you do, then which are the issues you would put top of your list in terms of the ones that we need to think about tackling? And my second related question is, if that is the approach, then how big a problem is it that the governance of these institutions has been so slow to reform? You know, I have sat in more meetings than I care to admit about quota reform at the IMF and the issues around voice. And I think KU pointed to some of those issues in terms of developing countries not having adequate voice. We have some institutions where it's one country, one vote, like the UN. We have other institutions like the Bretton Woods ones where it's economic power determines the size of your vote. And then we have a bunch of other institutions that have lots of different, more ad hoc structures for governance. Is it a problem that the governance is so untidy? And do we have to address governance of these institutions for them to be credible to deliver the solutions that we want to the issues that we think are important? Who would like to go first? Nick, do you want to have a go?
Well, thank you very much, Manoush. I think I gave my view on issues before institutions, I hope, fairly clearly when
you did.
I emphasize that we have to invest much more. We have to. It has to be sustainable investment. It's urgent, and that we can see the implications of what's necessary for the actions that the institutions need to take. At the same time, I think as we push those actions forward in the institutions, we're going to have to see how they change, how they will need to change. For example, there's going to have to be a great expansion in the ability of the MDBs to lend. Who is going to contribute to that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. How are they going to contribute to that? Will their contributions, will their changing relative contributions, including China and in particular, will they start to bring with them some change in the structure and power within those institutions? So I suspect that as we move to tackle those issues, we will see the necessity for at least institutional radical reform, but certainly important adjustment in the weight of decision-making within those institutions. And certainly on climate, the weight of decision-making of countries like, particularly China, India, Indonesia, and so on, we will have to see that rise. And that's going to be enormously important. So acting on the issues, I think, will bring change in the institutions, but I certainly would put it that way around. I also wanted to associate myself very clearly with what KU had to say about the role of China. But I also wanted to link it to the ability to get together. Now, in COP26 in Glasgow, in the second week, we had a US-China statement crafted by John Kerry and Xie Jianhua, but it was rather a constructive, friendly statement about moving past coal, about the importance of investment and innovation and new technologies, and it touched on finance and so on. And show me how many friendly, constructive, important statements that US and China have made together. Not so many in the recent past. But that was the recent past, in November last, and it was very significant. So my point is that if you start with the issues and see how you can tackle them together, you start to get collaboration in ways which could be fruitful for other dimensions of collaboration. If you can see ways forward and work together on one issue, you might be better at collaboration on others. So I think the issue story also helps with the collaboration stories. I would also, if we get time, like to say something about India, because India is going to be the fastest growing major economy over the next 10 or 15 years in the world. It will play a bigger and bigger role. It will be the biggest population in the world in just a few years. time. It's declared for a new form of growth. That was an important speech by Prime Minister Modi in Glasgow. And the story of India and Europe and China and the US will be very important. And at the same time, as we highlight those four very big players, we've got to be very careful about what we say about Africa and Latin America, because Africa is clearly going to be a major contributor to world expansion of population and to the future of the world as a whole, and Latin America as well. So I think seeing those big players and not just focusing on just one pairwise activity is going to be very important, important as the US-China relationship is.
Thank you, Nick. Just checking if Chris or Kay, you want to add anything, then I'm going to turn to audience questions. Chris.
Sure. Just to jump in on that, I agree. The proliferation of institutions seems to be the sort of tenor of our time. We build institutions, create working groups, task forces, and sort of they multiply accordingly. Where to house them effectively? I think the crisis of legitimacy as presented has been partly one about representation, and within that is a larger question about decision making, how the distribution of authority and within those institutions, and in a way, it's a I think it will be a self-regulating situation. That is to say, those institutions which fail to adapt, fail to recognize, become less and less central to the decision to solving the key problems. So I think about the G20, which was a lot of hope was put forward for the G20s to play after 2009 to play a significant role in re-legitimizing international activism and cooperation in that way, and it seems to have underperformed. And you know, we can ask ourselves for what reason, but that sort of failure to on the part of G20 and or the institutions to fully step up to the plate will define who's in and who's out and which institutions increasingly matter in a reformed Bretton Woods system.
I'm going to take the first two audience questions, if I may, from Hugh Sandeman. What recent successes can the panel point to in global economic governance, and what are the lessons from those? I think Nick just identified that example of the joint US-China statement on climate in the run-up to Glasgow, but there might be others people want to mention. I would put the OECD corporate tax proposal as another example, but panel may have others. And then a second question from Kevin Ryan on how likely are the traditional liberal countries such as the US and the UK to engage in a new form of global economic governance that are not significantly tied to core liberal values around things like human rights. So recent successes and lessons and issues around liberal values underpinning them. Any thoughts on those from anyone?
Nick, go for it. I try quickly. I do think the 2009 G20 macro response was a significant collaboration.
Yeah, agreed.
But they went and messed it up by premature austerity afterwards. So it was a major step forward. But then I think we had a very slow growth underinvestment decade, from 2010 to 2020, in large measure through bad economics. Yeah. Through premature austerity, to cutting back from the expansions far too early, to not letting growth emerge. So for me, it was an example where good economics could have led to better international action. A second example, and we don't know how it's going to play through, is the way in which Europe has come together around the energy crisis in this last month or so. That's a remarkable coming together of Europe, and we don't yet know what that consequences will be, but they could well have consequences for the role of Europe on the world stage. And to some extent, Europe and the United States have come together around that as well. So it's not the recent months in Europe, United States, is not, as it were, a full international action in the way that the 2009 G20 was. It's not a full international action in the sense of COP21 in 2015 and COP26 in Paris, in Glasgow in November last year. But I do think that there is an international reaction of real significance around what happened. And one of them might be something that could lead to a stronger movement together, and that is the recognition that energy security issues and climate issues are very much in harmony, that energy security tells us to move faster, harder, away from fossil fuels, so does climate. So it may be that this last month or so will put new force behind energy change, climate, and so on, in a way which could have quite profound effects on the international balance of relationships and power.
Thank you, Nick. I'm going to give the next question to Chris and maybe Kayu from Mary Martin, who says, if we repurpose existing institutions, how would you address the deficit of public trust and confidence since the financial crisis in 2008, and what are in what are seen as elite organizations in a more populist political climate? Chris, did you want to start on that one?
I think that really the way to repurpose them and give them and re-legitimize them in that way is actually to start with the issues. I think that approach that we mentioned before is to recognize that the people are responding to the failure of these organizations, not just for representation is part of it, but it's the fact that they are not they feel that that's connected to not addressing problems that matter to communities, societies, and the like. So I think it is to be found in the actions they produce to address questions such as energy security questions, climate change, sustainable, any and many of the SDGs that are there. So I think the institutions dedicating themselves to an issue-based approach will find that the audiences and communities that they're looking to influence in this respect will be more responsive, and that process of repurposing will flow as a byproduct, a natural byproduct of that.
Hey, did you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, I think there's also a difference to be made between confidence in one's own domestic institutions and international confidence in a major economy. And so I think there's been a deterioration of confidence in Western countries for a variety of reasons, including growing inequality, etc. In China, it's a little bit the opposite. I would say until recently, there has been even greater confidence in the domestic institutions and governance, government, political leadership. Partly viewing, you know, the economic decline and political decay in other parts of the world and chaos, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, this is the reflection of, you know, general surveys taken on Chinese citizens, of the fact that their government is accountable and responsible, even though they don't go to the ballot box. Now, however, a country like China's challenge is how to garner international trust. And that will be very important in all kinds of ambitions it has, whether it is to internationalize its currency, you know, adopt central bank digital currency, or global coordination on the issues that we have mentioned. That requires trust. And so for a country like China that has been traditionally very successful with the hardware stuff like infrastructure, and this is one of the issues I would mention as a success, part of the previous question, to promote greater connectivity through infrastructure and digital connectivity, especially for developing countries. And by the way, if China did not fund them, and there are a number of issues with this, it might not get funded at all, and that would be a problem. But ultimately, the success of the US post-war in terms of that leadership comes from a perceived moral universalism, a legitimacy of the American power, which is, of course, being challenged today for a number of reasons. But for China to do what it intends to do, where is the soft power? From where comes the moral legitimacy of China's leadership? And so that transition from hardware to software, hard power to soft power is something that global leaders like China and the US would have to face. And lastly, I would just want to mention in relation to the second question, but only tangentially, so we're actually seeing a lot more regionalization of agreements, whether it is trade agreements or the kind of new institutions that Manush has mentioned. Well, part of the reason is that they are issue focused. Some of the issues are so big that they require expertise and focus and potentially a new set of governance mechanisms and economic models to address this, such as infrastructure, but also the increasing regional trade agreements and investment agreements within the APAC region is also a reflection that there might be more similar, not only a similar set of goals and to address some challenges, but also in terms of values as well. So that is a likely phenomenon we'll see into the future.
Thank you, Kay. I'm going to give one last question for Nick from Julia Ring from, I was going to take a different question. Why don't I take that? I was going to take the questions from Hannes Berggren, which came in first, about the proposal for a climate-dedicated capital increase at the World Bank that the Center for Global Development has put forward. What do you think of that idea, and how can international institutions reform to address climate issues while not losing their core mandates? And if you have time, Nick, maybe I'll also add in the Julia Ring question, which is the role of multinational corporations and private entities and how we can involve the private sector more effectively, including increasing their accountability.
Yeah. I work quite closely with the Center for Global Development. I think that expressing it as a climate-related capital increase probably gives it a better chance of happening. And so I'm comfortable with it for that reason. But more generally, given what I said earlier, I think what we want is a capital increase. That's it. Because from now on, we should be doing sustainable development. I mean, who wants to do unsustainable development? Please raise your hand. This is something where we now have to have investment, which is clearly judged by whether or not it promotes sustainable, resilient, and inclusive growth. So I'm comfortable with it being labeled as a climate capital increase if it increases the probability of it happening, but we want to set it in the context of now a new way of growing, a much more attractive way of growing, cities where you can move and breathe, ecosystems which are robust and fruitful, people with skills and health to participate in these new technologies and ways of doing things. And all those things feed off each other. So I'm fine if you call it a climate increase, but remember, it's a sustainable development increase. The private sector question, I do think what we're seeing now is an understanding, which is deepening, of the role of the private sector and a corporation in the economy, which is much richer and more sensible than the rather narrow and, in my view, rather stupid view that we had pushed on us in the 80s and 90s, that the sole function of the firm is to maximize the profits, and in particular the short run profits of the firm, and not to recognize its place in society. I think that's irresponsible because these institutions are so important in society, but it's also very likely bad strategy for the firm as a whole, taking its position in the longer run. You know, firms that look after their employees better, see their stakeholders, firms that get on well with their community, firms that take sustainability seriously, firms that understand risks in a broad sense more deeply are likely to be the firms that are going to do better over the longer term. So I think that changing understanding of the role of the firm, I think, is very important. Colin Mayer has offered the definition of the purpose of the firm as dedicated to finding profitable solutions to the problems of the people and the planet. And the first word of substance in that center is profitable. You know, if it doesn't make profit, it doesn't survive. As another friend of ours has said, that that we, unless we breathe, we don't survive. But the purpose of life is not breathing. Yeah? And so I think that richer view of the purpose and role of the firm is something which is a real advance in the last 20 or 30 years. I do think the academic world has contributed to making that happen. But so too, we've seen strong leadership in the private sector as a whole. And one manifestation of that was the Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, where firms, asset managers, are managing 130 trillion dedicated embody the key objective as net zero by 2050. That's ballpark half the assets under management in the world. So I think we have seen a change. I think that's something that we have to push still harder. I think the role of students, the role of employees will be very important. Students decide where they work. Students decide which kind of pensions to sign up for. And I think that, and of course, firms in their communities are interacting or should be interacting in much stronger ways. So I do think that's changing. And I do think that the pressures come from employees, they come from investors, they come from local communities. And I do think that's one of the healthier developments that we see. I don't want to sound too rosy, because there are real deep problems of accountability, and particularly in high-tech data-based institutions, which are essentially global, that are real problems. But I wouldn't want to be too pessimistic or too negative about that.
Thank you, Nick. So I think the panel has provided, an endorsement that an issues-driven approach to thinking about global economic governance reform is the right one, but that we also have to look at how these institutions work and collaborate together to make sure that they're able to deliver. And also that thinking about politics and policy is really, really important. And I think they've given us no shortage of issues that we need to delve into deeper. And we will be doing that over the coming months. And so I wanted to thank the panel for getting us off to a very good start with this conversation, and remind people that we will be holding monthly panels over this year to focus on the big topics and to go a bit deeper on issues around trade, tax, monetary policy, development, climate, as well as providing a historical overview on global governance reform and a Global South agenda panel as well. These commission events will be scheduled over the months to come. Please do join. And also just a reminder that the next event that we'll be hosting will be a week from today on the 7th of April at 11:30 UK time with noted economist and policymaker Fred Bergston, who'll discuss his new book, The US versus China, The Quest for Global Economic Leadership, with Kei-Yu Jin. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you again to the panel and to all the commissioners and to the audience. And I very much hope that this will be the start of several more interesting and exciting conversations around the future of global economic governance. Thank you.